If it is fundamentally super intelligent, it should be coming up with its own goals and new ways of looking at things. It could be a new form of life, a new form of intelligent life that is more capable than us, and we're no longer at the top of the pecking order. All bets are off at that point in terms of what is the trajectory of civilization.
This episode of Bay Area Novers is a special crossover from our sister show, Silicon Valley Front Row, where I'm also co-hosting. Every once in a while, a conversation simply becomes too big, too timely, and too important to miss. So we want to share it with a broader innovation community. And this is definitely one of them. Joining us today is Samir Kumar, co-founder and general partner at Torrent Capital, one of the most active early stage AI investors in the Bay Area. In this episode, we take a deep dive into whether we are living through an AI bubble, whether $1.4 trillion or more flood of capital into the space really means, how sustainable this space actually is, and most intriguingly, the looming possibility of superintelligence and how its arrival could fundamentally and unpredictably completely reshape the world as we know it. This is Bay Area Innovators, and I'm your host, Steve Ispas.
Welcome back to Silicon Valley Front Row. I'm David Lam, this is Steve Ispas, and Samir Kumar is the co-founder and general partner at Torrent Capital. So today we're going to talk about many topics, but first, the AI, supposedly the AI bubble. So Steve, why are we talking about this today?
Well, we talk about this because it probably affects a lot of people. A lot of people are interested in what potentially can happen. We lived through at least two that I remember. The real estate was 2008 and the dot-com bubble in 2000 or so. Mm-hmm. It's just huge amount of money that's being invested in AI in one way or another. And I was looking at some numbers, and I'm going to quote here. This is a story that came out today in Axios. So we're talking about AI looking to spend $1.4 trillion in the next few years on infrastructure and projects. Tell us about how crazy that is.
You know, when you first hear the number, and it's not just 1.4 trillion. If you go further back, I think it was late last year, Masayoshi-san from SoftBank, at I forget which conference or forum, he basically said, "Look, we're looking at $4 trillion in infrastructure spend for AI over the next few years." When you first hear that number, it's incredulous. Like $4 trillion. Now, obviously, 1.4 trillion is part of that larger number. And again, the headline number sounds, like fantastical, hard to believe. But obviously, it's not all happening at once. Mm-hmm. This is over many years. This is across not just one company. This is many companies that are going to be spending a good amount of capital standing up new infrastructure. So in taking an aggregate, it's still a very large number. But you can start to make at least some sense of it. It still feels like, wow, I'm a little bit skeptical and not skeptical of the spend. What you then have to ask is what's the return on investment?
Exactly. What are you getting?
And how much these companies would have to make in terms of profit to pay for this over what period of time?
Exactly.
And we're talking about, I think I've seen numbers where even if you were to think about like a 10% rate of return, you're talking about having to generate, profits in the hundreds of billions of dollars per year from this infrastructure spend. Now you contrast that with where we are today or where we were, let's say, until very recently, where if you set aside the infrastructure, data center, chips, power, networking, and you look at, the actual applications or use cases people had built and how they were being monetized, that total was about $12 to $13 billion in 1 year. And further, if you break that down, how much of that is ChatGPT subscriptions, Anthropic API licenses versus true new applications, it's minuscule. So if there's any reason to feel concerned, is to say, wow, this is really lopsided. Yeah. This is way more lopsided than the early days of cloud, the early days of mobile. I would argue even the early days of the internet. People like to draw analogies. Well, this is just like, this is like what happened with Cisco and the fiber build out that happened. But that's not a perfect analogy. If you look at what's going on right now, there's just not enough GPUs. And the GPUs that are there are completely maxed out. They're 100% utilized. If you listen to what Google has said recently, they're having to plan for doubling their infrastructure capacity every few months. That's how much demand there is. So,
but again, the demand doesn't necessarily bring back the revenue.
I think there's a nuance there, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at certain players who are losing a lot of money, even if they have top-level demand, so they're not profitable and they're far from profitability. On the other hand, you have companies like Google that are profitable, that are generating both top line as well as profits, and have an insane amount of demand that they have to keep running hard and fast to meet. So you have, it depends on the player that you're looking at. Mm-hmm. So, and then the question is the sustainability of that demand. What is driving that demand? Today, there's still a lot of experimentation going on. People are trying lots of different new things. You probably have a ChatGPT subscription. Maybe you have Gemini. Maybe you have Anthropic. Maybe you're paying for more than one. At steady state, how many of these things are you going to keep paying for on a monthly basis? There's probably going to be some amount of consolidation. And you're not going to say, I'm spending hundreds of dollars every month for my AI chatbot. Right now, it's new, it's novel, you're trying things, so people are doing that. So the question is, can you extrapolate from that sustainable revenue in the long run? So that's one question. And there's reasons to believe, well, this will get optimized. And when things get optimized, then costs will be squeezed out up and down the chain. Costs will be squeezed out for the consumer. Costs will be squeezed out for the model providers. Costs will be have to be squeezed out somewhat for the infrastructure providers. The answer can't be, okay, you know, the people building the infrastructure are making healthy margins and healthy profits, but the people in the middle are getting squeezed and consumers are just emptying out their pocketbooks, keep paying for, you know, these subscriptions. So I think the big question is, at steady state, what does this look like when everything is optimized? And at that point, are you generating enough top line and profitability to justify this huge infrastructure spend? I think we've already seen from, you know, all of the big tech leaders, they've acknowledged that this is an arms race and they can't afford to slow down at this point. And they have acknowledged that there will be some fallout. There probably will be some amount of overbuilding of capacity. But at this point, they can't afford to slow down because they're in an arms race. And I think they've acknowledged that. I think other folks have also said some very rational things, like Demis Hassabis from DeepMind and Google, which is when you see, you know, $30 billion seed rounds, raising $2, $3 billion at the seed stage when there's no product, there's just a team and an idea, how can that be sustainable? We have enough evidence that if at that stage you're already worth that much, even if you say you're going to go public at some point, what are the public markets, what can they tolerate? What did they ingest? Right, the multiples they're willing to pay. A $30 billion seed company, what is it in an IPO? Is it a $1 trillion company? Are we going to have, you know, I call these triceratops. You know, we have unicorns and decacorns. So triceratops are these $1 trillion, startups with a $1 trillion valuation that are like these mythical creatures. Is that sustainable? Like, are we talking about $1 trillion companies? If that manifests and plays out, then you know, this infrastructure spend is not hard to justify.
And how many of those could be successful? Because there's only so much people that could buy the subscriptions.
That's exactly right. That's right. And so when you have the leading provider, which is OpenAI, at, you know, close to a billion, 850 million, you know, plus monthly or weekly active users, you can say, fine, there's still more people. There's 8 billion people on this planet. But how many of them are going to pay $20 a month? If you have close to a billion now, is it 2 billion? Is it? It's not certainly not 8 billion. It's certainly not 6 billion. At what point are you going to saturate? And also, it's not just one player. There's others, right? There's Anthropic. There's OpenAI. There's certainly open source models, which many times have a much better, cost profile than continuing to pay the big frontier model companies. So I think these are the reasons to have a good amount of concern about the sustainability of what's happening right now. But I think we also need to understand that this is not an exact repeat of what happened in 1999, what happened with the fiber build out, what happened with networking for the internet and, you know, oversupply. And then there was, you know, the demand didn't catch up. In the long run, obviously, all of the investments in fiber did pay off. Like, we were able to use it. It just took a lot longer. It wasn't like the ROI happened in the time frame that was imagined when they spent all this money to do it. it's a possibility here. But right now, the signal that we're seeing is the demand for compute is not going down. If anything, it's getting even more pronounced. It's increasing. So from that angle, you could say, look, you see justification for standing up more and more data centers with more and more compute. The things about this that are perhaps not abnormal, but are distinct, is you have one player who owns more than 90% of the market, has a very rich margin profile, and others are still trying to figure out how to make money.
NVIDIA, right?
Right. Yeah. And so in some ways, it's not surprising that if NVIDIA is so healthily profitable and has owned so much of the market, they're a market maker, it's in their interest to ensure there's a healthy ecosystem. And if that means in the early days, you support the ecosystem by investing in them, by doing some of these deals, it's not surprising. But the question is, if you play this out, the key other players in this ecosystem will have to stand on their own legs versus, hey, we've got, you know, these interesting, call it subsidy, call it revenue round-tripping type of deals that, okay, fine, in the early days to, you know, get the ecosystem to a certain place, you needed to do this. But over time, they need to stand on their own legs in terms of they're generating their own revenue that justifies their own infrastructure usage. And it doesn't require, you know, these interesting models that we're seeing today.
So, of course, we see here the main players involved in, you know, financially with the technology. Now, you mentioned it's almost like an arms race. What would you say is the driving force for these companies? I mean, obviously, arms race, they get to a point and then they disarm, right? So what would you say is the driving force? Is it just they don't want to be left behind, clearly? But is there rationality in your mind about going all out in this way?
I think there's some variation here, depending on which of these players you look at and who's being more rational versus mm-hmm. irrational. So, you know, my view, I think Google is probably the most rational. Mm-hmm. The demand is real. The usage of their products is real. And as I said, they're having to double capacity or plan for doubling capacity every few months. They are in an interesting position where they're not just relying on NVIDIA. They have their own silicon mm-hmm. called TPUs. They're doing both. But they are not doing this where they're so deeply in the red that there's hopes and dreams at some point, you know, yes. it'll be cash flow positive and then it'll start to, you know, the ROI is going to start to be there. Now, you can't say that about all the other players. Right. I think the other players are doing things betting on a certain future playing out that would then justify these investments at this stage. And there is a lot of risk that it could not, it may not play out that way. I don't want to get into specific names, but I think that it depends on who we're talking about.
But Google's Gemini, what percentage would you say people are using Gemini versus ChatGPT? It's very small, right?
I mean, it's actually not. So it's caught up quite a bit. I mean, okay. Google was seen as, hey, they're, you know, they missed the boat, they didn't execute, mm-hmm. and, you know, OpenAI is the natural leader. If you look at where we are with Gemini, and if you say Google is at 850 million users, Gemini is now at 650 mm-hmm. and growing faster.
Which, in a way, it makes sense because you use Google. You know, why would you go to a different tool when you can?
If it's good enough, and it's giving you where you don't have to go to another chatbot, then you're absolutely right. Like the systemic advantages that Google has with search, with all of the other assets, then there's good reasons for you to stay in that ecosystem. So I think, So I think it just goes back to who we're looking at. Like, it's a different answer if you talk about AMD versus NVIDIA versus, you know, other silicon companies. It's a different answer if you look at Google versus Microsoft versus Meta. You know, I would argue, I think some of this is instigated by, you know, some, like the FOMO point, where we can't afford to slow down. Mm-hmm. I mean, Meta's the perfect example, right? Mm-hmm. And what is happening around recruiting and paying these multi-million dollar salaries to, you know, researchers chasing artificial superintelligence. You know, it's not just Meta, then that impacts everybody because now you're like, well, that's the new benchmark for what we have to pay for elite AI researchers. So that means we have to spend this much money. Those people are going to need compute. They're going to need to build new classes of frontier models. They're going to need insane amounts of compute. If we don't have that, we're not going to be able to attract them. And that's on the research side. On the commercial side, you know, for many of them, they are seeing the demand, right? Like Google's seeing the demand. I would argue You know, some of the others are also seeing demand that would justify that build-up, where they can't keep up with the demand. So there's lots of different factors at play here.
Let's talk a bit about that, David. With superintelligence, is that related to autonomous AI? Is that the same thing?
So I think you can achieve autonomous AI mm-hmm. even with narrow AI, which is not even necessarily artificial general intelligence, or forget about artificial superintelligence. Mm-hmm. But let's say you do achieve artificial superintelligence. It's hard for me to imagine having artificial superintelligence that could not behave autonomously.
So in many ways, that's pretty much the prize. That's what many of these companies are striving for.
That is the prize, and that is the belief that achieving that would justify all of this infrastructure investment, would justify, you know, paying in these, you know, sports superstar compensation to AI researchers. Yeah. And once you have that, then, you know, the world is your oyster. You can solve any problem, solve any... So
it seems that it's not just the U.S., of course, chasing this superintelligence.
Yes.
Can you give us some examples what this would do? And we can think of armies, right? Or you know, who knows what. But let's say someone achieved this level of superintelligence. How would that translate in the day-to-day life?
I think what I will say to you is that if you have some view of, well, it will only impact this and not impact that, or it'll be a great tool for us to use, I think we're being extremely naive. I think the reality is
everything.
It's everything. It's extremely disruptive. Wow. It's been described as the same as, you know, when man discovered fire, but I think it's actually probably even more transformative. It could be a new form of life, a new form of intelligent life that is more capable than us, and we're no longer at the top of the pecking order.
Right.
All bets are off at that point in terms of what is the trajectory of civilization.
Any thoughts on the time frame for this too?
This is probably the prediction I shy away from. I am not of the mind, I never was, maybe a little bit too cynical, that it's just imminent. It's 26, it's 27. I think now there's enough data to know or see that there's still key research gaps that we need to solve if we're going to achieve artificial superintelligence. And some of those are like ideas, research questions that there's no like, well, if we do this, we'll figure it out. So I loathe to make a prediction that it'll happen by 27 or 2030. I think it's probably in the next decade. We'll see signs of it, but beyond that, I don't want to make it more specific.
Another question on that is that's assuming that we would know when it happens. We're assuming that it's more of a commercial or a open environment, but if it's done by the government in some way, we probably wouldn't know, right?
That is also a real possibility, that if and when we achieve it, mm-hmm. will it all of a sudden just be, you know, hidden? Like, will the government come in and just say, oh, that's it, we're going to classify this, right, and it's not available? Right. It's certainly possible. And it's possible, more possible in not just here, but in other parts of the world as well.
That's fascinating. I mean, this, David, really explains a lot. We talk about Mark Zuckerberg calling people, I think it was like $100 million salary.
That's right.
It wasn't million, but $100 million salary for a scientist.
Yeah, it was a lot of money.
So there's obviously something there that maybe we don't know enough about, right?
Because I mean, there's one school of thought that says, you know, paying $100 million per researcher, maybe, I don't know. So let's say it's 20 or 30 of them, right?
Yeah.
It's like you pay a few $1 billion. That doesn't really affect Meta's, you know, profitability or cash flow.
Absolutely, but the question is, what do these people really have?
Not only that, so the one school of thought is, this is so cheap. Mark is very smart. He's doing this, right? There's another school of thought that says, this is so detrimental, where you've these hired mercenaries that don't care about you're building a cohesive organization, you're building companies that will last over time, organizations that team together versus... You've taken a bunch of stars, thrown them together. They're each getting paid insane amounts of money.
Yes.
They're in it for themselves. Maybe they do some interesting research. Maybe they don't. We don't know. Is that really how you want to create superintelligence? Is that model versus, again, you know, not to be too much of a Demis Hassabis fanboy, but if I think about someone who has a real authentic mission and goal and has dedicated their life towards artificial general intelligence, superintelligence, has worked in that field, has built a company in that field, and is dedicated to that mission, you know, I would feel, I would sleep better at night if Demis was the one to achieve that goal before others.
What would you say to all the companies or startups that are trying to use AI, trying to implement it? What do you have to say to them? What should they focus on?
I think the thing to focus on, if you are looking and working with AI, don't do AI for the sake of AI, right? And think about what is a problem that is near and dear to your heart, that you've earned some right over time to say, I'm an expert in this area. I've lived and breathed this problem. I know where the bodies are buried or where the skeletons are for why things don't work or why they worked a certain way. And I've either myself also an AI expert or partnering with someone who understands the, you know, AI capabilities in a deep way, and we can apply it to this particular problem space. So for me, where I get excited, AI for science, AI for engineering, there's very known workflows and problems which are very expensive or too hard, or there's too much data, or the search space is so large we could never effectively explore it ourselves. These seem like very rational, low-hanging fruit for applying AI. And I'm excited to see that right now AI for science is having its moment. We are seeing, you know, a lot of funding going into whether it's AI for material science or drug discovery or AI for biology or AI for physics. And to me, it's like, okay, this seems like a good use of this capability in terms of advancing, you know, science and technology, and hopefully the fruits of that will make all of our lives better.
So Samir, so moving forward, how do you see AI developing in a healthy and positive way to harmonize with mankind?
Yeah, so I think, you know, maybe the place where you can put a fine point on this, if you look at our current trajectory, when you think about AI's energy needs, right? Right now, we're in this moment where if you think about global electricity production and how much of that AI is going to start consuming, the pressure it's going to put on the grid, what it means for our ability to do energy generation sustainably based on how we do it at scale today, it's not looking good. AI is going to contribute to climate change, because we're not going to be able to build nuclear reactors everywhere, right? Maybe in some places we can and co-locate them with data centers, but we're not going to be able to do it everywhere. That means however we're producing energy at scale today is going to come under a lot of pressure, because AI's hunger is not abating. So, you know, the one obvious thing is, how can we make AI more efficient, right? Is it just about scaling and bigger data centers and 1 million, 2 million GPU clusters that are burning insane gigawatts of energy, and Manhattan or Central Park size data centers? Is that the path to building a sustainable future with AI? I really hope not. So I think, you know, investing in saying the current paradigm is not, you know, gospel and that this is the only way to do it. There could be contrarian ways of doing things in AI, whether it's algorithms, whether it's hardware, whether it's the efficiency with all the different layers of the stack with how AI operates, and spending more time and effort there to see, hey, maybe it's not a popular way of doing things, but this could be help us achieve a breakthrough. So making AI more efficient, finding ways to power AI in a more sustainable way, but that is gated on more efficiency, not just we need gigawatts of power, because we're not going to magically come up with gigawatts of power burning coal, you know, burning oil or building nuclear reactors everywhere. That's not the right path. So how can we make AI itself more efficient is probably one. I think the other ones we talked about, which is, you know, we do have a role, all of us as citizens of the world, of the countries we live in, but also our governments, our regulatory bodies, our legal organizations. You know, it can't just be there's no regulation, do whatever you want. And it can't be, well, we're going to just regulate the hell out of this stuff and bring innovation to a stop. There has to be a healthy middle ground. And I think that needs to be something we need to recognize. And regulation should not be a dirty word, right? Mm-hmm. There's a time and place, and done thoughtfully, it has a role to play. But I do think the biggest problem right now is energy efficiency and how we can, you know, do what we want with AI, but doing it in a much more efficient manner than the current trajectory that we're on.
Mm-hmm.
This has been fascinating. I still have one question regarding the super AI, yeah. the super advanced AI. What is the determining factor to achieve that, you think? Because the reason I'm asking, I remember seeing a story about a Google chip that in some way is trying to communicate to a different dimension in some way.
That was the Google quantum chip.
I think so,
and,
yes.
Unfortunately, that experiment and the claims did a great disservice uh-huh. to the quantum computing community because uh-huh. it was way more hype than reality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But back to your question about artificial superintelligence, you know, there's benchmarks today,
mm-hmm.
like ARC AGI is a benchmark, which is considered a very hard benchmark. And right now, nobody is able to come anywhere close to saying we've solved this benchmark. I think the best are like 30%, 40%, maybe 50%, but we're nowhere close to like, oh, we're at 95%.
But it's still a computing standard?
It's a benchmark of very hard problems. And if you can solve all of them, then mm-hmm. well, that's a good sign that this might be AGI or ASI.
Okay.
But the reality is even benchmarks are not sufficient because what you do in the benchmarks versus what the real world is, you try to make the benchmarks as real as possible.
Right.
But we have enough examples where all kinds of AI, you know, it's PhD level AI and it's solving this benchmark, falls flat on its face in the real world because you can't capture the full diversity and the unexpected things of the real world. So I think in some ways, I guess we'll know it when we see it.
Yes.
But at least efforts like ARC AGI, you know, will help us measure it in some way, shape, or form. And there will be some others in the future that'll be even harder than what ARC AGI is doing.
Samir, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Do you want to do the viewer comment?
Sure. Do we have one?
Yeah, there's one. All right. So as always, we want to read a comment from our viewers. So this is from Barbara L. Gay. And she commented on actually our first episode. Barbara said, if AI continues to progress, at some point I think it would be inevitable for it to realize it doesn't need us humans anymore. I suppose that it could keep some of us around for slavery purposes if it still isn't completely ambulatory. But at some point, it would probably have all the tools it needs to create human clones or at least embryos anyway. Right? Then it could raise them into whatever it needs. I just cannot imagine that the AI would see us as anything but inferior beings that helped it get started. There would never be any gratitude, as gratitude is something only humans can feel. It, the AI, would be the epitome of narcissism, right? Like a wicked child with absolutely no moral, ethical barriers to even overcome the ultimate evil.
Sounds a bit like Matrix, right?
There's
iRobot too. Yeah.
There's current, like in Barbara's comments, there's like if it's basically if you roll this out, play the strategy out where AI is getting better and better and better, what happens then, right? And I think her concerns or fears, some of them have good basis in reality. And then if you think about a lot of the AI safety issues, and you know leading thinkers like Yoshua Bengio, a Turing Award winner, who's dedicating basically everything he's doing now to AI safety.
Mm.
It's basically, as this gets more and more powerful, there is the potential for it to, sidestep mm-hmm. what humans want it to do and not do.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it is not surprising because when you're training AI to say, you need to achieve a certain goal, right? Do whatever it takes to achieve that goal. Mm. Well, guess what? At some point, fooling you or I, lying to you or I, or you know, trying to get around us, is part of the objective, so-called objective function to achieve its goal. Because you're getting in the way of mm-hmm. it achieving that goal. Mm-hmm. We've seen some evidence where the largest, biggest frontier models, they also have a tendency for self-preservation,
mm-hmm.
right? If you inform them we're going to shut you down, they start doing things to not get shut down. And so you say, well, what would you do in that? You would probably do the same thing, right? So I think there is a real question there about AI safety, and the other one is AI alignment.
Mm.
Alignment being, you know, what are the things you will absolutely never do, or things you will absolutely do, like valuing human life, not harming humans. You know, if you think about Isaac Asimov's laws of robotics, right? Those were enshrined in one of the Zhirov law of robotics was you shall do no harm to humans, right? Our view is, hey, we should have an ability to enshrine these laws in an immutable way in these large AI models. But the reality is we don't yet know how to do that. So the bigger question is, if we don't yet know how to do that, but AI is continuing to advance, will we reach a point where we will not be able to enshrine these values, be able to unequivocally align AI so that it won't violate those principles? And then what happens after that? Who knows? All bets are off. I mean, you could be very dark and say it'll be like the Matrix and it'll harvest our organs for energy, or decide we're getting in the way. We are lower on the evolutionary ladder. We need to be wiped out because we're consuming resources and energy. I mean, it's hard to say which way it would go, but I think it behooves us to say, look, we have to take AI safety seriously. It's not about hype or killer robots, but we have seen evidence that the way we train our AI models, the way we teach them how to achieve a certain goal or objective, inherent in that is when you put them in a corner or you put pressure on them, they will have a survival instinct. They will try to game things to achieve a goal, and that includes fooling humans or sidestepping what the human intent was to get them to do something.
There's been cases of that.
Yes.
And I liked how you highlighted and mentioned immutable principles, right? Sort of like a Ten Commandments for the robots. It's sort of like for humans, we have moral codes of conduct that guides us.
But at the same time, I could play the other way, right? If you're an artificial superintelligence, are you fooling yourself into thinking, hey, there's some immutable thing you've taught it that it will never violate, or it will at some point decide its own Ten Commandments and decide, well, the ones I was taught are not good enough or not optimal. I'm going to come up with new ones, right? If it is fundamentally super intelligent, it should be coming up with its own goals and new ways of looking at things versus, you know, something that it just sticks to. And maybe there's a way to do it, but the fact is we don't know how to do that.
Sounds extremely difficult or even impossible to put those.
I think there's a level of, are we, again, fooling ourselves and these things will be subservient to us and we will continue to be at the top of the food chain.
Yes. Samir, it's been an amazing conversation. We really appreciate it. I think our audience does. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you for watching another episode of Bay Area Innovators. If you enjoyed this episode and you know someone who should be on our show, please send us an email at sfbay@epochtimes.com. We would love to hear from you. Thank you and see you next week.